a name named after a deceased astronaut. Well, this is the first time they actually named it for somebody that didn't make it into space. He named it for Chaffee from the 1967 explosion, Apollo 1 fire that they had back in January 27th, 1967. That's where you lost Ed White. You lost Gus Grissom, as well as Roger Chaffee. So they decided to name it after him in honor of him, and it successfully made it up to the International Space Station, launched on the Antares spacecraft. Cygnus docked with the ISS a couple of days later, and they were able to start unloading the cargo on board the Antares rocket. The Antares rocket actually separates from the Cygnus. NASA put some small satellites in, very small satellites. They're called thin satellites, thin sats, and it was 63 of them mounted to the second stage of the Antares rocket. They deployed 63 of these small satellites. Some of these things are made by colleges and even high schools across the globe. There, it's part of the STEM project that NASA's involved with. And it's the first time I've seen these things go up. These things are about the size of a piece of bread. You take white bread, and gives you an idea of how big each one is. And each one has solar panels on it. Each one has a transmitter, some kind of cameras or little experiments that they're doing. So I thought that was interesting. But nevertheless, the Cygnus docked with the space station. And inside they have the 7,500 pounds of stuff. But inside of that, they have something called the Astro B. Astro B these experiments, these little robots, or actually good sized robots. They're about a foot cubed, and on board is they have cameras, they have what you call it, tablet attached to it, where astronauts will be able to use this thing. These are flying robots that will be put in the inside of the space station, shaped like a cube, and has this fan motor, an intake fan, and it goes to these six different vanes or valves. Depending on how they open and close, this thing can orient itself and fly through the International Space Station. And they have names for these two that they're sending two up, and in the future they're going to be sending a third one up. One is called Honey, the other one is called Queen, and the other one is Bumble. But they're Astro Bees. About 6 months ago, they sent up a charger for this system, and they attached it to the wall on side of one of the modules. I believe it's in Kaibo, a Japanese module. So this thing can fly and can attach itself to this charging unit, charge up its lithium batteries, and then it could disconnect itself from the charger and start flying through all the modules. And as it goes through, it has cameras on board. It could be operated by either the astronauts on board or by mission control in Houston. It could do different things. It could take readings of the air pressure, the air quality in each ship module. It could scan for things. It has an RFID detector on board. Dick knows a lot about that. Every tool, every gadget inside the space station has an RFID tag on it. So let's say Ann McLean, one of the astronauts, says, I don't know what I did with this type of test equipment or tool. I can't find it. I have no idea what module I left it in. This thing could fly through from one end to the other, and it will read the if a RFID just goes through, and if it picks up the one that they're looking for, it'll say, okay, it's over in the Discovery or in the Columbus module, and the astronaut could go and get it. Or this thing can actually bring it back. It has a claw on it, a claw attached to the astro bee, and it could bring you things. Or it could, let's say it's flying through, it could grab a hold of a pipe or some kind of a handrail inside the space station, and it could just stop. And it could save its battery, just hang out there for as long as it wants. And of course, if it starts to detect that its lithium battery is starting to get low, it starts to fly off and flies all the way back to its charger, connects itself up, and recharges. So I thought it's pretty good. Eventually, they'll have three. They now have two up there. Apparently, I haven't seen them operate them yet, so maybe the astronauts haven't gotten to it yet. But I'll be following that story all along. Any kind of flying robot inside of a space station, you know, you got my attention. They're replacing the spheres. They used to call them the spheres. They were little soccer balls. They did the same type of thing with, you know, not as advanced as this thing. This thing has the RFID readers, and it has the claw and all this stuff. You know, they're upgraded versions of what they used to call it, the spheres. Let me drop it for any comments or questions. This is WS2N. Okay, there being none, here's a spacecraft that I started to follow before the last net. And it's called Barysheet. And this is the lunar lander built by a company called Space IL. Comes out of Israel. And they're taking this thing. It's not too big. It's a little bit bigger than a washing machine, but it's got four landing legs on it. And they needed to see if they could get this thing to the moon and land successfully and transmit pictures back. This is part of the original Google contest that they had. You know, you could win like $10 million if this could be done. Well, Google, you know, canceled all of that because nobody met the deadline in time, which was 2017. But these people kept on going over to Space IL, and they built this thing, and they did it for under $100 million, which is a low cost for trying to get something to land on the moon. And part of that cost was $20 million worth of it anyway, was to hitch a ride on board a SpaceX rocket. SpaceX was sending a geosynchronous satellite, a big one, you know, one of these 7,000-pound things, to a geosynchronous orbit for the country of Indonesia. So they said, well, we got room at the top of this thing, so for another $20 million, normally it would cost you $63 million for a SpaceX ride to orbit. But they made a deal. And they attached this vehicle with ground rings for separation with 24 spring-loaded gadgets that were compressed. They had to match that. I say they, Space IL did, over in Israel. This way when it was sent over to the United States, they were able to attach it to the top of the Indonesia rocket, which was done successfully. And when it was launched, Barysheet was the first vehicle to be deployed. You know, the first stage went perfectly. First stage came back and landed successfully in the water about 600 miles out, or I'd say in the water, on a ship in the water. Second stage with another Merlin engine took the both crafts to near geosynchronous transfer orbit, released Barysheet to go to the moon, and successfully put the Indonesian satellite into orbit. Well, Barysheet kept going, and it went around the Earth in an elongated elliptical orbit, and every time it came down to perigee, it would ignite its own thruster and gain more and more speed. And after about a half a dozen orbits, the parachute was ready to be pulled in by the orbit of the moon itself. They had a time to where, when it got out that far, the moon was there. So the moon, it came up actually behind the moon. The moon was in front of it. And then they used that, the gravitational pull to pull it into orbit. They just needed to turn the vehicle in the forward direction and fire its thrusters to slow it down. And I think around 400 miles an hour, they needed to slow it down to pick up the gravitational well of the moon. And with that, they were the first private company to successfully orbit the moon. So that was a big accomplishment. They needed to land it. So within a day or so after that, they again changed the attitude of the spacecraft and pointed it into the direction that they were going and slowed itself down again with their engine. Their engine could only, you know, be on or off. They couldn't throttle this engine. You know, they would have needed a lot more money to have something like that. But it was hypergolic, so it would ignite with nitrogen tetroxide and the fuel. But again, they couldn't throttle it, and they slowed itself down. It took a nice picture, a selfie of itself with the moon down below. And when it got, I think it was around 500 feet off the moon, it was facing in the wrong direction. Some kind of a glitch had happened. And in fact, because it was actually facing in the wrong direction, when it did fire its engine again, it started to even go faster, and they figured out from the telemetry that that's what happened, and it crashed into the moon. So they got close. But not to give up, I've already heard from a report that SpaceL is now being funded again. They raised money, and they plan on launching another parachute-type vehicle to try again in about 2 years. So that should be interesting. So they did good, but close, but not close enough. Let me drop it. Okay, any question on parachute or anything else? This is WS-20. Okay, another accomplishment that really went very well was the one-year mission of Scott Kelly. Scott Kelly was one of the astronauts that spent almost a year, just short of a year, on the International Space Station a few years back. And he has a twin brother, Mark Kelly. Mark Kelly is also an astronaut. They both have flown on the space shuttle. This time, Mark Kelly got up there by a Soyuz rocket. They had plenty of testing that went on with both astronauts. One was on the ground, and the other guy's in space for a year. And the tests are now finally released. They found out a lot of things that they knew and a lot of things that they suspected and a lot of things that they're going to have to work on to improve space flight for astronauts. You know, they look further into the muscle density atrophy and the bone density of the astronauts. They lose like 3% a month or something, and they have to exercise vigorously. But they found out some other things about their eye problems, and they would like to know more about this topic. So with that, recently, one of the people on board the space station right now is a woman named Christina Koch. Christina Koch went up there about a month ago. She went up there with another American astronaut and a Russian astronaut. He was commander. Took a Soyuz up to the International Space Station. And she's been up there for 1 month, and NASA, you know, let her know that now she's going to stay for a year, almost a year, you know, similar to what Scott Kelly did. Apparently, she got the heads up before she went up that they might ask her to go on an extended mission. But still, it must be kind of weird, you know, you're up there about a month, thinking you're going to stay for about 6 months, and you get the word that, oh, no, you're not coming back on that same vehicle that you went up on. You're going to come down on a different vehicle. You see, the Soyuz goes up there, only has a limit of like 240 days. So that means that vehicle that she was on, that one has to come back, and they'll leave her behind, and she'll eventually come down on another Soyuz rocket. And there's also another guy named Morgan. He's eventually going to be going up, but he's going to have a one-year stay as well. So they need to make more studies, trying to figure out how these people are going to react, not only for Mars missions. You know, you're going to go to Mars. It'll be a three-year mission, roughly 8 months to get there, you know, a year on a planet. Another 8 months back, you know, you need to be okay for, you know, basically for 3 years. Not only for that, they're going to eventually now have these lunar landing missions that they're planning. They plan on putting they call it a gateway base station around the moon. Plan on doing that, and they plan on eventually going down to the moon and creating some kind of a base there. People might be gone away from, you know, for months at a time, or maybe even longer. If they ever get to the point where they could leave people there. Now, they're a long way from doing that, but they want to know ahead of time. So that's the deal on that. Let me drop it. If there's no questions, I'll move on.
Paul, if they're going to leave an astronaut for more than a couple of days on the moon, I presume they're going to be doing that at the North Pole or the South Pole of the moon. At that very low sun angle, I am guessing the temperature up there is quite cold. So that spacesuit better have an awful good heater in there if you're going to leave them there for more than a couple of days. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, that's the biggest problem. But, you know, I mean, there's no air up there, so, you know, the air, it's, you know, there is no air to deal with, so there's no, you know, wind coming by and, you know, from convection, you know, direct contact from moving air, you know, pulling the heat away from your body, you know. It's all either, you know, you're either getting direct heat from the sun or not. And like I said, they want to know years in advance. I mean, my guess is, you know, for actually having an astronaut staying on the moon for, you know, 6 months or a year in some kind of a base, you know, might be 20 years away. But, the astronaut information on their health has to be known now, you know, before they even think about doing anything like that. And as well, you know, eventually they want to be able to send people to Mars, you know. So again, that's years away, but they got to know now. And especially if they're going to leave people on space stations, you know, they would like to leave people on a space station for a year instead of 6 months on a regular basis. It cuts back on the expensive payload for every mission they get. You know, that takes place. Back to you, Dick.
I'll admit that the moon has no atmosphere, and therefore convection cooling of the air hitting your suit, air that's cold, that factor is gone. However, when you're standing on the North Pole of the moon, half of the hemisphere that you see is all of the dirt below you, the lunar soil, and that lunar soil is going to be sitting at minus 150 to minus 200 degrees centigrade. The other hemisphere is the cold sky, which is at 3 degrees Kelvin, which is minus 268 degrees centigrade. So the sky is super cold, the earth below you is super cold, and you're sitting there in your warm spacesuit radiating heat like crazy. You better have an extremely good heater. I am guessing that your suit would need I'm going to pick a number, 500 watts or 1,000 watts of continuous heating in that environment to make sure you don't freeze. Where's all the energy going to come from to run that half kilowatt or kilowatt heater in each of your spacesuits? That's run by a battery. How long is that battery going to last? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Well, first of all, you need a base. You know, they're going to have to, you know, eventually dig into the moon's surface. You're going to need modules on the moon, or, you know, probably first, and then eventually create something underneath the moon. Try to get away from some of these problems. And then fission reactors, you know, they're building these things now, and they've run quite a few successful tests with them, each one is creating, you know, 5-10 kilowatts of power. And if they send a half a dozen of those things up there, that's going to help. Combine that with solar panels and, you know, as backups, and if they can get, you know, liquid out of the, you know, water out of the craters, you know, you could maybe eventually have oxygen and hydrogen for breathing, breathing in and for fuel. And then you can recombine them again, and, you know, maybe you could run fuel cells and eventually, you know, get the water back again. You know, we're talking about, you know, evolution on the moon. It's going to go from, you know, well, it's already started, really. It started 50 years ago. Let me drop it. First LEM that went up there only lasted, for a day. They weren't even up there, I think, 20 hours or something. So they were running on battery power only. So that was it. They didn't have any fuel cells on the LEM. They had fuel cells on the Apollo, but not on the LEM. And as time went on, they upgraded the system. I think 15, 16, and 17 were upgraded LEMs. And that's why when you got to Eugene Cernan and Harris, when they stayed on at Harris, when they stayed on the moon, they stayed for over 3 days there. So, I mean, so, you know, it's already evolved. It's gone from 1 day to 3 days or 3 nights. Not that it got night up there, it was still daytime. And eventually they'll be able to get to the next step. You know, it's like anything else. It's just going to take time, money, engineering. Back to you, Dick.
You would be led to believe, from what you just said, Paul, that they only stayed 3 days because of the energy to run their batteries and other equipment. I don't believe that. Depending on whether they chose the gray zone, the gray line, where the sun is rising on the moon and the sun is setting on the moon, it's either going to be getting hotter or it's going to be getting colder. So beyond 3 days, when you carefully choose a landing spot, beyond 3 days, you're going to have an amount of heat you can't tolerate or an amount of cold you can't tolerate. If at the equator of the moon, you establish a habitat, let me pick a number, 10 meters below the surface, there the temperature might average, some nice room temperature average down there. But it's going to take you a month of construction to dig the hole and establish that habitat down there. During that month, you're going to be living at ridiculously hot temperatures at high noon on the moon and ridiculously cold temperatures at midnight on the moon. With our current technology, that spacesuit can't tolerate the high temperature, can't tolerate the cold temperature. So that month of construction is going to have to be done in an unmanned manner. So that's no easy task to establish that habitat. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons they want to have the Gateway space station up there. She'll be situated 40,000 kilometers away in a halo orbit. That's what they wanted to do at one point. And from there, you could have satellites going around the moon and transmitting data, TV, telemetry back to who's ever on board the Gateway space station. I mean, this is what they want to be able to do. They want to be able to put robots, you know, essentially bobcats and earth digging or moon digging gadgets on the moon, and you're going to operate them with the help of astronauts in real time from this gateway orbiting facility. And they could do anything they want with theoretically, you know, without anybody on the moon. You could dig down and whatever it's going to take. That's why I'm saying, you know, decades from now, you know. But eventually it would get done, and then you could send people down there.
Is the Gateway station going to be in low lunar orbit around the moon, Paul?
Yeah, well, originally they wanted that out at 40,000 kilometers, which is, you know, they feel they could sit there pretty much in one spot, you know, and operate things, and then talk about actually orbiting the moon. I mean, they don't have the plans, 100%. I mean, they have Lockheed. Lockheed's already worked on the propulsion unit, and that would be the first part of that would go up. And then they're going to send the habitat unit up, and then they're going to send up a docking setup, and then they're going to send eventually a crew up. You know, all these first components are going to dock autonomously, and then when the crew comes up in a you know, Orion spacecraft, everything's going to be ready for them, you know? I mean, they've got these plans. I've seen them actually a couple of years ago. So these are long-term plans. But that's their goal. That's called a gateway.
The 40,000 miles, is that the gateway at a synchronous orbit around the moon, so that it's always sitting above the same spot? And therefore, you're controlling the machinery that's doing the digging and whatever. And so that machinery is going to dig the hole to establish the habitat something like 10 meters below the surface. And when that's all established, eventually you put a man down there. And I guess you could periodically send a man down for a couple of days and then send him back up to the gateway. You know, shuttle back and forth. When the moon gets too cold or too hot, you shuttle back up to the gateway. So that's a possible method of operation. So to establish this habitat below the moon with the cats on the surface and the gateway station and whatever, I am guessing we're talking about $200 million in investment.
Repeater, time out.
That $200 million of investment, how do you justify that, Paul? What do they get in return? They get a way to dwell on the surface of the moon quasi-continuously. And yes, you could call that practice for going to Mars. But I'm convinced that your and my great-grandchildren are not going to see an astronaut standing on the surface of Mars for a whole bunch of reasons. It's going to take the resources of all of planet Earth to finance that. It's 1,000 times further away than the moon. The moon was $33 billion in 1970 money, the Apollo program. Mars is 1,000 times further away, a hell of a lot more dangerous for a whole lot of reasons, and you're going to need contributions of all the major nations on planet Earth to finance that. And each of those nations are going to say, if I give you one-third of my gross domestic Mars, who do you call K2IW?
Okay, yeah. Well, that'd be good. I would like to cut that picture out and hang it up. The Chinese plan on doing this by themselves, with no help. They plan on going full blast. I mean, they got a long way to go. I mean, we spend, I think it's four or five times the amount of money that China spends. But they're getting up there. They're spending as much as some of the other countries now, India and even Russia. They're getting close. But they have definite plans on sending people to the moon and maybe staying there, obviously. But if anybody makes it, it's going to be SpaceX. They have their problems now, but just, you know, I talked about the failure they had with the Dragon crew vehicle. They had a big success. They launched the Falcon Heavy again. That's the one with the three boosters. Each boost is 150 feet high. And they bolt them together, and they have a second stage on top of that, and then they have the satellite. In this case, they launch a satellite, communication satellite for Saudi Arabia, and they launched this a few weeks ago, and it was successful. They took off. The boosters separated. They came back just like they did a year ago on February 6th, 2018, when it made the news, and they showed the two boosters coming down, and the fins opened up, guiding itself down to the launch complex, coming down to landing zone 1 and 2. The legs, the 60-foot span of legs, opened up for them. And
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Florida. The booster, the center booster, kept going 600 miles out to sea and wound up landing down on the autonomous vehicle and successfully landed there. Fortunately, it was rough seas, so normally they have something called the Octagrabber. It's a gadget. It's got 8 sides. This big door opens up on the autonomous ship. Let me drop it. Massive door opens up, and that rides this massive contraption. It's a Octagrabber, and it rides on, and it's got big tractor wheels, you know, like you would see on a Caterpillar or a Earth Mover, and the thing rides underneath the booster. Booster landed successfully, and the idea is to ride out underneath, and it's got these arms, and it reaches up, and it grabs a hold of the bottom of the booster, and somehow attaches itself to the, where it can't fall over, and then it rides all, the ship rides all the way back to, gets towed all the way back to Cape Canaveral. They've done this successful many times so far, but this booster landed and everything was fine, but because of the rough waves, the booster did fall over. I mean, it broke into two. They managed to save the engine. They'll probably reuse them, knowing them. The booster itself was lost or damaged to a point where, no good, but they did bring the engines back. But it's still bringing the cost way, way down. Give you an idea. Now, this is not the rocket that would eventually go to Mars. Elon Musk for SpaceX is all about Mars. He's building now something called a Starship down in Texas, near a place called Boca Chica, Texas. And, in fact, I found a good website. A webcam. Let me drop it. If you put in Starship webcam, put in South Padre Island, South Padre, P-A-D-R-E, Island, because this facility that he's got, this launch complex that he's building down in Texas to launch these starships that are eventually going to go to Mars, they're able to see this about 6 miles away. They have this camera set up. Somebody's got the cameras, not SpaceX, but somebody's got this thing on South Padre Island, and it's always staring, well, most of the times it's staring at the rocket that he's building, just to see the development of this thing. And the reason I was looking at it, they had put one engine in there, one of their new upgraded engines. Instead of the Merlin engine, he's got something called a Raptor engine, much more powerful. And this thing is massive. This thing is like 30 feet in diameter. I think it's 33 feet in diameter or something. And wanted to be able to take off just a couple inches. He just wanted to see if everything would work. And they did that, and successfully. But, you had to keep watching the webcam. But it's cool to watch anyway. Sometimes it's foggy. You can't see anything.
How much thrust comes out of that Raptor engine, Paul? Did you say it's got a cone on it, 30 feet in diameter?
No, that would be the body, body itself, just like the Falcon 9 has 9 engines, but the whole the diameter of the booster is 9 feet, 13 feet. This thing is like just over 30 feet in diameter. Eventually, it will have 30. I believe it's 31 engines attached to it. Right now, he had one engine to it. If you look at you look at the information about it, they've already disconnected the engine because they tested it and worked. His next deal is, I think he's going to attach three of these things to it. His goal is to eventually start flying this thing, 500 feet in the air, 500 meters, and then eventually 5,000 meters into the air, and then fly, keep doing that, and then flying it back. Officially, it's going to be, what you call the Starship. This is the Starship Hopper. It's called the Star Hopper. But the Star Hopper is, it's a test vehicle. But it's pretty massive, and this is going to be the payload. This whole thing will eventually go to space, because eventually this is going to be put onto the super Starship booster, the super booster, and that's going to be the one with the that will actually have the 31 engines to it. This one will eventually have, I think this one will have 7 engines to it, and each Merlin engine, I think, is 200,000 pounds of thrust. This thing is going to be like, I think, around 400,000 pounds of thrust, roughly twice the thrust that you get out of the Merlin engines. Merlin engines go on the Falcon 9. The Raptor engines are going on the Starship. These are liquid methane engines. The old Falcon 9 rockets, they're all RP-1, they're kerosene, liquid methane. Back to you, Dave.
What was the thrust of the main booster engines on Saturn V? And I think you said now these Raptor engines are around 400,000 pounds of thrust. That's a nice big number. Go ahead.
Yeah, and you can imagine he's calling it the super heavy booster. It's going to have 31 of these engines, each one producing 400,000 pounds of thrust. So you're going to be in over 13 million pound thrust area, which is going to be like twice the thrust that you would get on a Saturn V. Saturn V, I think, was 7.5 million pounds of thrust. Each engine on the, they had five engines. Each one was 1.5 million pounds of thrust on the Saturn V thing.
If a Saturn V engine is 1.5 million pounds of thrust for one engine, and these Raptors are only 0.4 million pounds of thrust, it's smaller than a Saturn V engine. Seems like we're going in the other direction now from Saturn V. Go ahead.
Yeah, we have a long way to catch Von Braun. He had they were called the F1 engines. So he had five F1 engines on a Saturn V. The reason you're going to get more thrust out of this system is because there's going to be 31 of these things attached to the booster. Where the Saturn V, you had five. So you had five at 1.5 million, and now you got up 31 at roughly 400,000 pounds of thrust each. I think I remember reading you're going to get over 13 million pounds of thrust with this thing.
Does it have graceful degradation? Can you still do the mission if one or two of those 31 engines fail during the launch?
Yeah, it's just like the Falcon 9. And Falcon 9, that did happen on one of the earlier flights. They got the and they're still able to make it to orbit. So they will have that. But that's all a ways away. I'm expecting the first... I want to see the Starhopper go up. And whenever I hear that's about to go up, I'll go to the South Padre Island webcam and see if I could see this thing live. As long as I'm home. But, wow. This is what's going on. Other people are trying to make cheap flights as well. He's trying to bring the cost down. But Stratolaunch finally got off the ground. Stratolaunch, if anybody followed this net for years, I've been talking about that thing. That's the one with the big wingspan. It's got the wingspan, it goes from like one end of a football field to another. It's over 300 feet long, and wingspan, and it's got six 747 engines attached to it. So it's a massive thing, and he finally got it off the ground, and it flew a couple thousand feet in the air, no problem, and then landed it And the idea, it's a carrier plane. It's going to take rockets up. They're going to drop it. And they're going to go to orbit. So that was a Paul Allen from Microsoft thing that he built. He passed on just, he died, I don't know, 8 months ago, and he didn't get a chance to see this thing take off. But they said his wife was there, so.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
How old was Paul Allen when he died? Sounds like he died at a not very old age. That's question number one. Question number two. Saturn V F1 engines, I think they ran on liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. That's part of how they got such a huge amount of thrust. The liquid methane engines for Raptor, is that a so-called safer fuel but not quite as energy content, but easier to use, doesn't have to be cryogenic? I'm guessing the liquid methane doesn't have huge amounts of cryogenic temperature to keep it in a liquid form. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's, well, yeah, liquid methane, it's like running liquid natural gas, you know, it's probably under pressure. They don't need the backup helium tanks that they have on the Falcon 9. And Saturn V, the first and second stage boosters were kerosene, RP-1. You're thinking of the third stage, the S-4B. That was the third stage, and that was liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. The one, you know, that's the one that they needed to, blast themselves to the moon and back. You know, once you're in Earth orbit. So that third stage was liquid hydrogen. So another question about Paul Allen. At the clock here. Paul Allen, he died relatively young, but he had some kind of rare sickness for, I don't know, 10 years or something. He knew he was sick. I forgot what it is. I could find it on the internet, but I know he was sick for a long time, and whatever it is, finally got him, unfortunately. He's always pushing for space stuff. He had the Paul Allen Array out in California. Looking for little green men, you know, pour a lot of money into stuff. Back to you there.
Yeah, all of a sudden I'm having trouble remembering the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence group out there. Okay, you've run out the clock, Paul. 73, and back to you for a final.
Okay, very good. I'm glad everybody's back, and we're back in business. Hopefully we'll be here next week. 73 guys, and we miss Eric, but we'll carry on. He's always on his net. Turn it over to Roy, too, if he's still, I'm sure he's still there. He's always the AC2GS, WS2N. Back to you.
Over to you, Roy. And you probably want to give your addresses one more time. And thank you for all that material. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Yes, thank you, Dick. Thank you, Paul. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight and participates on a weekly basis. Once again, if you have any mailbag questions or topics or anything, you can email me at mailbag@ac2gs.com. And all the topics that I covered will have links. They are already active on my webpage, roy.ac2gs.com. And I want to thank everyone and wish them a good week, and it was very sad to hear about Eric. He will be missed by many, many, many of us. So this is AC2GS, and I'll be going clear now.
Net tonight at 8:30 WQVL repeater system. The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the WQVL repeater. at 8:30. Welcome to the WQVL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Tonight at 8:30, WQVL repeater system. Tonight at 8:30, welcome to the WQVL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Morning. The time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30 WQVL repeater system. Thank you. tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the WQVL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System.